friends. Welcome to Brap Talk, where we talk about brapping and talking. I am your host, Shaheen Alvandi, and next to me is the handsome, illustrious Quentin Wilson. You know, it's one of my favorite things about the Middle Eastern accent is that the W doesn't really exist.
It's a V.
Yeah, it's a V. You're a Wilson.
Yeah, sure.
My best friend's Egyptian, and they speak Arabic, and there is no P, as in Papa. Papa would be Baba.
Ba, so it's with a B.
It's with a B.
Hmm.
Yeah. So
very good.
He has a very good bubby that I bet all the time when I play with him.
What are you talking about?
That's a puppy.
Is that,
that
a euphemism?
Hey, you down to podcast?
I am DTP. You know me.
You know me. What have you been up to? It's been a minute. It's been a week since I've seen you.
Yeah. Have been doing motor dyno work with electric motors, which is a very strange thing.
How does one dyno?
Well, funny you should ask. So it's interesting that most people will know a dyno. If they're in the motorcycle world and they know a dyno, they know what is it called? Not Superflow. Superflow is what I know. Dynojet.
Dynojet. That's right.
It's so funny how my brain just
went
complete
tilt. The worlds are colliding.
Yeah, right. So Dynojet is a gigantic electric motor that when you spin up the drum, there's nothing that I can't. I have to go into deep dives with everything,
you do,
right?
You do.
Okay, so
I'm here for it.
A dynamometer is a tool. A lot of people think it is just to measure horsepower, and that is probably one of the least things that it is. The most that it is to evaluate and categorize a vehicle, right?
Okay.
So if you just got to look at it like there are different types of dynos, just like there are different types of motorcycles. The most basic one is an inertia dyno. You basically take a drum that is a set weight, and the drums are generally between 900 and 1,000 pounds, somewhere in there.
Wow.
And your acceleration and deceleration of that drum is what allows you to, and there's sensors on it that allows you to gauge torque and then do a calculation of horsepower, because horsepower is torque and time. So how much work can you get done in a certain amount of time? And I forget all the specifics of that, and I can't tell you the numbers you have to multiply and divide and, you know, square or whatever to get to the horsepower number from knowing a torque number, but it's torque and time. So if you really want to evaluate a motorcycle, though, you need to be able to put it under a load, not just spin that drum to get a number, because you can just get, I accelerated that drum from, you know, 30 RPM to 70 RPM, and I did it so quickly that it has to have make this horsepower.
Mm-hmm.
You have to be able to load it to see, okay, is the vehicle taking the load of, say, going up a hill or air resistance, right?
How do you give load on a drum?
A gigantic electric motor that is essentially turning itself into a generator, because you'd put a load against it. So it's like an alternator on a car. It's a drag on a car's engine. Like if you're actually creating charge, it's a little electric motor running backwards, basically, to generate electricity by passing magnets over copper windings. So same goes with this. And they're normally called eddy current dynos. And I'm not about to try and get into the mainly because I'm very new at this. I'm learning a lot being in this electric world.
Huh.
But eddy currents are complicated things, but that's what you'll often hear them called, as an eddy current dyno. It's either that or a water brake.
Somebody's listening right now going, well, actually, it's
yeah,
easy.
no, for sure. And you want to nerd out on it, great, so you can nerd out on it. I would love to be able to have these conversations with somebody that's super deep into it, but I have used them. So I've used a water brake Superflow dyno at Moto Sizz. We
nice.
Had an engine dyno that the engine just bolted directly to it, and we had a chassis dyno that had the eddy current on it. So we had both of these things, and this was 15 years ago. So it's very cool for me to get back into this, because it's been 15 plus years since
right.
I was in it. So to have, and I'm surrounded in this facility that I'm in on Swan Island with super hyper nerds, like full respect, amazing, high level, deep electric vehicle people that have been doing this for 15 plus years. So there's a lot of stuff. It's not like I'm just doing this in a vacuum and freestyling it, right? And it's super cool.
Somebody gave Q the key to the place.
Right. No, I'm watching these people and I'm learning, and it's super cool.
So you're dynoing boat outboard motors.
Yeah, well, we're just dynoing straight up. I'm putting a putting a motor against another motor, which is essentially what I've just been describing as that gigantic.
Right.
Because the what Dynojet has used for probably 30 or 40 years, whatever long they've been running eddy current dynos, I believe it was a something that came off of like a truck. Like it was like a engine brake. Often they will put these motors as brakes, much like a locomotive.
That's right.
Is an electric motor. Like when you see a locomotive going down the track and you see the belching gnarly diesel fumes coming out
of it. That's just a generator.
Exactly. So, and a lot of people don't realize that. And it's so funny to listen to all the electric haters, and especially when you flip them on that, what is the most powerful, gnarly, badass thing that we have all over America? Electric vehicles.
Choo-choos.
Hybrids at that, right? So anyway, it was cool to watch that, to be able to put a motor against a motor and then watch the engineers and figure out how they are evaluating, categorizing motors. So first we were doing it with a little 100 watt motor that they were using for another application. So I got to watch them, you know, put it up to whatever Newton meter was a target. Like, this will make 15 Newton meters. And
I am not smart enough to convert Newton meters to
foot pounds.
Yeah,
you don't need to. But I
kilowatts
think
to horsepower.
It's close enough to like 0.75 of a foot pound or something like that. Whatever.
0.75 of a freedom pound.
Freedom units. So cool to watch that. That's what I've been up to. And then we were able to put our motor, on the dyno, but with a inverter, motor controller, that was like a known thing, and then watched it run, and we were able to spin the motor and verify it does the things. And then we're going to be putting on a different controller that we'll actually be using. So I'm just fire hose drinking, learning all the stuff. So it's been
the Kool-Aid's coming in hard.
Yeah, and you know, it's really funny. Like a couple days after that, I had if you're sharp, you'd listened and said you've heard me talk about working on my truck. So I just put a new engine in the truck.
Pulled it into the driveway, right? Today, folks.
Yep, and
running.
But it had been like the starter was like not happy. So I took the starter down not too far away from here, down to Johnson Creek Boulevard, and there's a dude that does starters and alternators.
Huh.
And he put my starter on a dyno. It was so funny. I was like, we're talking this crusty old 50-year-old place that this dude had been doing this for a long time. So it's like in a house, and he had a wood stove burning. That was his heat. Where he was working.
This guy's been there since
dude, it was so
1923.
So the juxtaposition of being in this super high-level AC motor world to going to direct current DC motor, which is, that's again, I don't even want to go down the rabbit hole.
Different.
But watching him click it into place and then run it and be like, yeah, it's a little weak, you know, right? It was so cool.
I like that you've just been dynoing things all week.
Right, that's all of us. That's what I'm up to, dealing with that.
You pulled up to the house and the whole house started shaking.
Yeah,
Dan's like, is Q here?
Yeah.
Yeah. What is that noise? Well, that's a big blue truck.
Yeah, that's whatever those exhausts are that the dude that owned it before me put on, right?
Look, and I tell you what, got the potato.
It's my decoy truck. That's where I'm like.
That's how you sneak in.
That is, right. It's so nice to be able to carry things. I'll say that because I've been riding. What? We did four podcasts.
Yeah.
I rode
always
in the middle of winter. I was here four times.
It's still the middle of winter.
And
it's
then tonight
February.
I was like pissed because I was like 5 minutes later than I should have been because I was on moto time. I was like,
not lane split.
Oh, I can't lane split. And it's like,
you can, which is going to make a big mess.
That's a big mess. That's a lot of
cars flinging everywhere.
Right.
Get out of the way. I got a fucking podcast to do.
What about you? It sounds like I had seen some pictures of you gallivanting.
I had a really chill weekend. We didn't do much. We took one of those little hyper monos down to Los Angeles. Dear friend.
Oh, is that what you rode the 360 miles on?
No. A friend who bought it did that.
Oh.
So, okay. So we
Of course, yeah.
We have a large Sprinter van between.
Yeah.
It's not mine. I say we. It's my best friend's van. I just get to drive it as often as him sometimes, so it's become we. I should probably make some payments.
We.
So the large Sprinter van can fit four motorcycles and a bunch of your shit. or in this case, an Egyptian, an Iranian, a street fighter, an old Monster S4R, and a little teeny tiny Hyper Motard Mono 698.
Okay.
So our friend Joe bought one from us.
Right on.
And I was like, hey, conveniently, we're coming to LA to go to a wedding that's going to be all Saturday. When I say all Saturday, I mean
All Saturday.
This shit started at 10:30 a.m. And we, hashtag Team Man, was like, babe, I'm tired. It was like midnight. It's like 14 hours into this thing. It's like, okay, guys, you guys are still dancing, and that looks like a lot of fun.
Is this Persian, Armenian?
No, this is Assyrian.
Assyrian?
Assyrian. Do you know anything about Assyrians?
No.
So unless... Assyrians, quick little
I love it.
Lesson. They are the original indigenous people of Mesopotamia.
Okay.
Which is like basically where Iraq and Syria are now.
Yeah.
And their language is their own. It's not Arabic. It's not Farsi. It's their own. It's very, very unique. A lot of them are polyglots, a lot of multilingual people. So like my dad's partner, Helen, speaks like six languages. And so this was her son's wedding.
Huh.
And
is she Assyrian?
She's Assyrian, yep.
Okay.
Yep. She's not a Syrian person. She's Assyrian.
Assyrian.
Which is funny because people are like, oh, you guys are going to Assyrian thing. I'm like, no, it's no. Assyrian.
Assyrian.
Okay. Super fun party that we get to go to. So it was kind of like this neat, you know, go to LA. Most sane people just fly there. It's about a 2-hour flight.
Yep.
We did a 14-hour drive straight down 5, got to Granada Hills, SA, and hung out with fam. So we got there on Thursday late night. Friday, we had the delivery of the motorcycle in the garage. And
Where did you have
to? In Granada Hills. Like, we did it in my dad's garage.
Oh, so he came and got it?
Yeah, he came. He rode from Venice with his trade-in, which
was... I was
going
to say, thank God you didn't have to drive down through the bowels of the city.
No.
You just came right down the 5, right past the Six Flags or whatever that thing is.
Nope,
you're right there in Granada Hills. You don't even have to go.
No, it'd be 5-118, boom, you're off of old Balboa.
Yeah, sure.
And so... initially, we were like, hey, it'd be cool to take this bike to the bike shed, which is...
What is the bike shed?
So the bike shed, for those of you who don't know, is an amazing place. It's essentially a restaurant, bar, coffee shop hangout for motorcyclists.
Where is that?
So the original one's in London.
Ah.
And then Dutch and his lovely wife who started that...
He's not English?
He's very English. I know, right? It's confusing. It's an English-Dutch. Dutch-English, you know? So Dutch started the bike shed in England and then opened one up. And it's been basically in progress or in process of opening since pre-COVID.
Yeah.
And then it opened up, I want to say spring of 2022.
Where?
In, like, outside of LA, it's off of like 6th, and I forget the crossroad. You know that really, really famous bridge that everybody...
Okay, so you're downtown LA.
You're in downtown LA.
Okay,
you're essentially like it's like the arts district.
Okay.
So it's this really, really beautiful 20,000 square foot facility that houses really cool motorcycles. There is a bar, a restaurant. There is a tattoo shop, a fucking, like you name it. Everything, everybody. And what's neat is... their whole concept is we want this to be open and inclusive to everybody and also motorcyclists. So tons of motorcycle parking and people roll up all day long in their various motorcycles and they have different events for different bike groups. No MC patches allowed, like none of that shit. Just come be chill. So because it's in downtown LA and because we have friends sort of from all over the greater Los Angeles area.
Yeah, yeah, great.
It's just
place.
Easier to be like, hey, let's just meet here.
Sure.
So initially we thought, hey, it would be cool to take the bike in the van to the bike shed and do a cool reveal there. And then as we're driving to LA and we're getting closer, I'm like,
no,
I fucking hate the idea of driving this 170 inch wheelbase, fucking 4-wheel drive lifted Sprinter van to fuck that.
Yeah.
So I texted Joe. I'm like, hey, I have a thought. Would you mind lane splitting on your beautiful Street Fighter V2 that I have to take back from you as a trade-in to Granada Hills?
Wow, that's very interesting that he's deciding to go that way.
He did.
Yeah.
The Street Fighter, I think his initial intention was to get a bike to commute on pretty much
yeah.
daily.
Yeah.
And a Street Fighter, although I have one and I was commuting on it until the Desert X came out, it's too much.
Yeah.
Especially
the V2?
It's phenomenal. It's so livable. I'm so used to it, but he wanted something. You know, we've talked about this a lot. It's so much more fun to exploit a smaller
yeah.
engine.
Yeah.
And it's so much more fun to go fast on a small bike than to constantly try to cork a fast bike.
We'll have to come back to this. Once you're done with your story,
yeah.
Street Fighters, remember, Street Fighters and my experience with Street Fighters and that exact thing. Okay.
Hey, y'all who are listening, just remind us to go back to this, okay? <All right. laughs> So
bottom line, he's like, yeah,
bike. Hey, I think I want to get rid of the Street Fighter and I want a smaller bike. And I was like, when this bike came out, he was super psyched about it. And so we did a deal. He was happy about it. And I was like, cool, I'm coming to LA anyway, so I'll just bring the bike to you. So he rode out to Granada Hills from Venice, and we did the swap there, and he sat on it, and he immediately like adjusted the handlebar to make it fit him. He's one of those dudes that wants the bike to fit perfectly so he can go and play with it. And so he took like 10, 15 minutes, fiddled with it. But as soon as he sat on it, it was the same thing we all said. He's like, oh my God, it's so little.
It's teeny.
It's so narrow.
Yeah, sure.
And it was amazing. And so we were kind of talking, and it's like, gosh, I wonder how different this is going to be from the Street Fighter. Polar opposites.
Completely.
Oh, God, yeah. In every way possible, right? Yeah, right?
Sure. It's got handlebars.
Which you kind
of sit up straight-ish, but...
You got mirrors and handlebars and an engine and some wheels under you.
A couple wheels, yeah.
So I think one of the... And he didn't say it, but I just wondered if maybe he suddenly had a trepidation about having a bike that made literally half the horsepower
yeah, sure.
of a Street Fighter. And so we high-fived. We're like, hey, cool. We're going to hop in.
Wait. You high-five on I-5?
High-five on I-5. God, I should have. No, except here's the thing. So the bike shed is in downtown L.A., which is like... 18 miles from Granada Hills.
It's about an hour and a half in traffic.
Dude,
I'm not even kidding. Like, that's
seriously
generous, right?
We went without traffic
yeah.
at like 1:30 p.m. L.A.,
yeah.
which still has some traffic.
Sure.
And I know the flow of the five. I live there, so
yep.
I know where to go.
Yeah.
By the way, we really lived up to L.A. lifestyle. My dad's partner has a Mercedes-Benz convertible. It's an E400 convertible.
I've never heard Mercedes.
It's her Benz. It's Mercedes-Benz. So we're in this black convertible Mercedes-Benz. It is 75 degrees and sunny in fucking La La Land. And I'm like, y'all, this top stays down.
Yeah.
And Anne and my best friend Tamara are like, yep, fuck yeah. So
yeah.
Roll the top down.
You're like, give me all the smog.
It just rained like crazy like a day prior. So it was so clear and beautiful.
You had one of the few days where you're okay.
We had two. Yeah, it was perfect. It was literal perfection. So it took us on a non-traffic day 45 minutes to go 18 miles.
Yep.
And anyone that's lived in L.A. Yeah. or any major city, you don't say how far a place is by miles. You say how far it is by like time.
Yeah.
Hey, how long does it get to your place? An hour.
Yeah.
It could be like 8 miles.
Yeah.
So it took Joe 20 minutes to get there.
Yeah.
20 fucking miles. Like, motorcycles.
Yeah.
So in that 20-minute span, as he was riding it there, he was giving a different load and playing with it. He got to triple-digit speeds that are more than I thought he would be able to get to. Like, according to the speedometer, indicated 130.
And it's why does that surprise you?
Because we were wondering how this thing was going to be geared and how this thing could get to that speed. Because in the Ducati world, we've got like the Scrambler 803cc twin, yeah. and that thing's geared and on the track. We've seen it indicated 120 something miles an hour.
Yeah.
But that's like it.
Right.
And Joe was like, dude, this thing got to pace quick, like in a rush, way quicker than he thought it would be. And so in his head, it was like, well, yeah, it's 100-something pounds lighter than the Street Fighter.
That's the key, right?
Even though it makes half the power.
And it doesn't, even though you are hanging out a lot in the wind, the bike itself is pretty small.
Yeah.
So if you can tuck well,
yeah.
and if you know the trick of putting your hand down on the fork,
Put it on the fork.
You can make it pretty yeah. small.
Super.
Not that small, but I mean, all things considered, because the cross-section area, the front of it, it's non-existent.
It's nothing. If you stand in front of the bike, it feels like it's barely a foot wide.
Yeah.
And Joe's a pretty slim dude. He's like 5'10", pretty slim athletic build. And
yeah.
so he's like the perfect candidate for that motorcycle. So anyways, he got there. We chatted about it. And he's like, oh, my gosh, the brakes. Oh, my gosh, the handling. Oh, my gosh, the this. Oh, my gosh, that. And it's like, cool. He loved it.
apparently he was all about the break-in procedure.
He was very much about the break-in procedure of just rap on it.
Because I wouldn't have gone 130 miles an hour. I would have done 80.
You know, the trick to breaking a bike in 20 minutes is just to write it how you think it should be ridden.
It is
forever
true.
And ever.
Well, so that goes back to I think it was the last podcast or the one before.
I think we were before.
That is, you know, frankly, that bike, as long as he kind of makes sure to change the oil and does all things, that'll be a happy motorcycle.
Dude.
Even though most people are like, I can't believe you put that much load. Yeah, whatever. You'll be all right.
All right, Boomer, you'll be fine. Yeah. it's not a CBX. It's fine.
Especially with a big old piston like that.
Oh.
Huge. What? That's like a inch, 4-inch bore or whatever.
I think it is.
Yeah. So a 4-inch bore. You need to give it some, and then what he did was get it way up, and then had to shut off throttle, like I was saying, and that hopefully bed those rings in nice and hard.
So
yeah,
that bike is just get ready. So that was Friday. We hung out at the shed, had a lot of fun. Look, we got a little matching tattoos, a little helmet.
What was the story on that? I saw a bunch of people have it.
So
was there a
Tamara? Tamara was like, "Hey, you want to get a matching tattoo?" I'm like, "Yeah, fuck it, why not?"
And is this a tattoo artist that already had that? Was it Flash?
I found it online.
Oh, and you're like, can you do this?
Yeah, I literally was like, hey, can you do this? She was like, yeah, totally.
Okay.
And so five of us ended up with this fucking tattoo.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. Anne's got it on her little wristlet, and Tamara's got it on his wrist, and he's got his deceased brother's race number on there, which is really sweet.
Okay.
Joe, the guy we're talking about, got his very, very first tattoo. It was that one.
He had no tattoo.
None ever. This is his first one.
That's very weird.
So, what? It was so sweet. And Haley, his partner, got one as well. So, yeah, a bunch of us went out and did the bike shed thing from, like, start to finish. We had lunch there.
Yeah.
Bunch of drinks. Hung out.
This is on Friday?
This is on Friday.
Oh, wow.
And then had dinner there. It was a seven-hour lunch. We were there from lunch till closing, essentially.
You packed a lot in a day there.
Packed
a lot in the whole weekend.
We sure did. So a lot of friends came. We chatted with a lot of people. Got to hang out with Dutch. Awesome, awesome group of people.
Dutch, who's British.
Who's not Dutch,
English?
Who's British.
I don't know.
Is it bad to say English or British?
Dutch? Huh?
I mean, both?
Well, you know, the British Isles, the British...
Are they the UK?
Whereas England
is... United Kingdom.
England, right?
England.
So we need a Brit. We need an expat to talk shit.
Yeah, right? webraptalk@gmail.com. Clarify Brit versus English for us, please.
We need Colin. We'll get Colin.
Oh, man, Colin will tell you how it is.
He will definitely tell us how it is.
I have a friend who's Welsh. He'll definitely tell you how it is.
Oh, well, he's not English, that's for sure.
Oh, no, he'll tell you. He's Welsh. So that was Friday. Saturday was a wedding for 14 hours. And then Sunday we got on the bikes and rode from fucking Los Angeles to
Idlewild.
No, so we started. We met some friends. Friend David, who works at Biltwell. Who we've talked about.
We're going to talk about him KLR 650s on every podcast.
So we had lunch together, and he said it was so neat to be riding a motorcycle through all of New Zealand and listen to Brap talk about him. He was like, this is surreal.
Yeah.
So, again, we've talked about this before. Davin is like my – you and Davin are like my get-out-there-and-ride-the-thing muse. He does insane amount of mileage a year on a motorcycle.
Amazing.
Amazing. And he goes in like dirt and road and everything in between and every different place. So, yeah, he did 4,000-something miles in New Zealand in 2 weeks. Basically, he did all the aisles.
Yeah.
Showed me amazing pictures, and he had a great time. So we met at, oh my gosh, I can't remember the name of the town. I told my dad where we're going. He's like,
Beaumont?
I was like, why are you going all the fucking way out there? So anyways, we rode on I-5 forever.
Did you get past the windmills?
Oh, God, no. So on I-5, we just went to Ortega.
And then I forgot you went south. Right. Okay.
So then we took Ortega Highway all the way up and down.
So Dana Point, Costa Mesa,
whatever. Way up there.
It's all the same. You went behind the orange curtain.
We went behind the orange curtain. We went to the land of the 909s.
No, that's...
We got close anyways.
That's the east side. That's the crime 09. That's right?
Easy. So, yeah, we went and met Davin and his partner, Tamara, who I will probably invite to chat on this podcast at some point. She has such a cool perspective of someone who only started riding maybe about 2 years ago. And she hopped on a Rebel 500, put a fuckload of miles on it, like within a year. Honestly, within 6 months, this girl put more miles on that bike than most American riders will in 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
So it was so neat to ride with her after not having seen her for about a year and a half since they moved to Temecula, and see how fucking fast and competent she is riding through corners. She now rides a Rebel still, but an 1100.
Yeah.
That thing's beefy, by the way.
No, yeah. That's the same engine that's in my bike.
Yeah, it's super, super
pretty
neat.
Good.
Yeah. It's like, anyone ever asks me, hey, what bike should I get as a beginner? It's like, Rebel. Just get a fucking Rebel. Get a 500. Get a 300. Get something small.
It supplanted the Ninja 250 / whatever, the old Rebel 250,
right,
which was around for, both of those were around well,
forever.
Long time past
forever
what they should have been.
And
so, yeah,
ever and
the
ever.
300/500? Yeah, I don't
a 300,
even know.
There's a 500 and there's 1100.
Yeah. Even the 1100, the fact that she was able to just basically get to that, because the power isn't that extreme. It's just very usable, and the bike is fairly light for being a cruiser-ish bike with a low seat height. The
right
key is the low seat height.
The low seat height. That is the key. It's very user-friendly, and it's very smooth, and it's a, you could see it is a massively over-engineered Honda that's just going to live to be forever.
Yeah, sure.
So anyways, it was neat to ride with them, but we went to Idlewild, which I hadn't been to in such a long time.
Yeah, man. Awesome.
Like, you were climbing the 6,000 feet elevation.
It's a great,
and it's
great
the most
road
beautiful ride on the planet.
Oh, it's so good.
There was snow when you got up there on the sides.
Yeah,
it was
good.
It was like 50 degrees. All the Californians, the SoCal people were bundled up.
Oh, no. That meant it was great for you guys.
Oh, dude, Tamara and I were like, this is amazing.
Oh, no. There's probably water rivers across the road.
There were.
And a couple places where the snow's melting. Ew, I don't want to ride in that.
We're all ass. And David's from Michigan initially.
Yeah, the UP,
Detroit boy. And, you know, he lived here for a long time. So he's such a smooth rider. You can put him on whatever, wherever, and he'll be fine. So we had a blast, went there, ate some food, hung out, rode downhill back the other side.
Okay, so did you go down into the Palm Springs area?
Not Palm Springs.
Indio,
just kinda,
or whatever that is.
Whatever it is. That
you were in the high desert.
We were.
Okay.
So beautiful.
Then did you come back on I-10?
No, we did 15 to 60 all the way to 5
okay,
to back to the bike shed because everything ends at the bike shed.
Yeah. Okay.
Especially in L.A. So super fun weekend, packed with lots of adventures, lots of photos, and a whole lot of laughs. And then yesterday just driving back from California, it's a 14-hour drive. You just put it in cruise control.
So it only took you guys 14 hours?
Yeah. 80 miles an hour. You just put it in 80 miles an hour. It's 14 hours.
Huh. I guess I felt that it from were you in Granada Hills?
Yeah. Yeah, so yeah, we're at the edge of LA.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah. No, I'm just thinking because, you know, when I lived in Pasadena and or was, you know, I lived in Chatsworth, which is only just like
that's right there.
20 minutes from where you were. That would still feels like it would be an 18-hour drive, but I guess
it's really, I used to think it is too, but if you can manage to keep it around 75 to 80 miles an hour
and not hit the traffic,
which we got super lucky, like, coming in to LA, we hit Sacramento rush hour traffic.
Yeah, yeah.
So we were stuck for like a half an hour.
But not too bad.
Not terrible.
Yeah, yeah.
And then coming up, we got stuck in like Stockton traffic, which wasn't really anything at all.
Yeah, sure.
I think it came to a halt like 3 times. And so it added like 15 minutes.
Yeah, not bad.
But what's funny is we were laughing because Google, you know, gives you the estimated time of arrival. And we left and it was like ETA, you know, 0124. So like 1:24 a.m. I was like, that's going to suck.
Yeah.
And we pulled in at like 12:18 a.m. And I was like, we fucking beat Google by an hour.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah, sure.
So
that must have been no In-N-Out stop on the way up.
On the way down, In-N-Out. On the way up, Tamara and I have a tradition called Danger Zone Chicken.
So what is that? I saw the place. I didn't recognize it.
So Danger Zone Chicken is anytime.
Danger Zone. Beauty
new. Anytime we go moto camping or doing long rides, we'll stop at any one of the side joints and get some chicky tendies, fried
and
chicken
JoJo's
tendies.
In Oregon,
and
you
JoJo's
have to get JoJo's.
Hey, if you all don't know what JoJo's are, get fucked. No, I'm kidding. If you don't know what JoJo's are, it's essentially like
a
steak fry.
Yeah.
That's thick and crunchy on the outside. But
extra
nice
thick with two C's.
Oh, so good.
And you can get them usually at like thriftways or gas stations.
They're so
in
good.
Oregon.
So we've learned
so many spots.
Our favorite brand for Danger Zone Chicken. So the reason we call it Danger Zone Chicken is we always want a bunch. We eat a handful there and then we put the rest in the bags of the bikes and go to our camping spot and then pull it out and eat the rest of it. It's like, well,
If I'm gonna get salmonella, I'm not gonna be
fine. So it's danger zone chicken.
Okay, got it.
We found our favorite.
I'm
brand.
Never afraid of that, by the way. Not even a little bit. I'm surprised you even like are worried at all.
We're never.
Tamer's been in the food industry, and he probably errs on being food safe.
No,
whereas like
fuck no, okay. No. Are you kidding me? Professional. Any of you that work in the kitchen will get this. Professional chefs don't give a fuck. They just put whatever it is in their mouth.
Yeah, same.
They're busy. Okay. Yeah. So, anyways, our favorite brand is Chester's.
Yeah, I saw that. I've never heard of it. Where was that?
So that one was in Wairika.
Which, if you know, is...
Yeah. Get in and get out. Fuck
way
off.
Out. Yeah, so, sure.
So on the way up, we stopped at Wairika. So here's the funny part. Beautiful weather. All the way on 5.
Dude, it is at the border.
Motherfucker, it's always at the border.
You could be in Nevada.
How?
On the other side,
dude.
And it will be clean and clear and beautiful as soon as you get into the Oregon. It'll be shitty and gray.
I was like, watch, because Ann messaged me. She's like, hey, be careful. There's like winter weather advisory. I'm like, okay.
Whatever. Yeah.
So as you're going north on 5 past Redding, you can see Mount Shasta on a clear day.
And you can then probably see the wall.
No, it was clear. It was
and you're
beautiful.
Like, oh, this is beautiful.
It's like, this is gorgeous. What are you talking about? So, you know, the sunset by the time we went past Redding and we kind of got to see a beautiful sunset and Mount Shasta Lake, which is very full, by the way. It's beautiful. It's
strange to see that.
So full. I love it. I love it.
For what? 2 decades. Oh, anytime you pass by it, like you'd see like 30 or 40 feet of brown. And so to hear that it's up, it's like full. Crazy.
So,
and I know that's a weird thing, but it is what it is.
Listen, man, this is the shit we noticed when we road trip. So we go through past Shasta. We get some crazy winds at the town of Shasta and whatever. Just keep going. And then we get to Weed.
Yep.
Winds get worse. That's right, folks. There's a town in Northern California called Weed. We don't make it up. Anyways, so winds get bananas. And so I kind of look out the windshield and it's like, no, it's crystal clear. It's just nothing but stars and the moon. And so we get to Wairika. We need fuel. Danger Zone Chicken. Get that done up. By the way, before Danger Zone Chicken, we stopped at KFC like in SoCal.
Yeah. Dude, why would you even do that?
We're like, let's just try it out.
No.
You know, two brown guys,
dude,
KFC.
It's either got to be Church's or Popeye's. You just don't go to KFC.
I'm surprised
you didn't have bubble guts from that. Oh.
Guts of steel, I guess. I don't know. Or maybe I farted a lot and didn't tell Tamer. So anyways, we get Danger Zone Chicken. We take off. It's beautiful. We keep going. Welcome to Oregon. Now, here's the thing. It's gotten cold enough where there's no more bugs in the windshield because we had to clean the bugs off. But I'm like seeing these little white things fly.
I'm like, man,
into the,
all these gnats.
Yeah. Like, I was like, man, I see a lot of gnats. And Tamara goes, wait, are those bugs? I'm like, no, because it's not really sticking to the windshield. It's not hitting the windshield at all. So then I'm like, huh, I wonder what this looks like if I put the high beams on. And it's fucking flurrying. Like, as we go up, as soon as you see the welcome to Oregon sign, it just became a whiteout.
Yep.
And it's like, welcome to the Siskiyou Pass.
Summit. Yeah, the Siskiyou Summit.
4,192 feet. Shit, this is playing here,
if
folks.
If you haven't done this and you're going to go on a long road trip, it's an experience. It's like the grapevine going into Southern California from the center. Same on the way out.
Right.
You've got this mega pass that goes all the way up from that, whatever you're going to call the Northern California, San Joaquin Valley-ish, you know.
You mean State of Jefferson?
Oh, man. Yeah, I do mean State of Jefferson. And going up that hill,
a lot of those.
It's gnarly. Like, I've had to do it in rental, like, moving van, and it's, like, painful.
It's gnar.
Yeah. It's
super gnar.
It's a thing that keeps us from escaping. Like, if you in the winter, if you're like, oh, I'm just going to go down to California to go ride in better weather.
No, you fly there.
You have to think about it. Like, it's either you go out to the coast and have to spend an inordinate amount of time slowly.
Average speed limit of 35.
Right,
yeah.
Going all the way down the coast because you could probably get past it, right? Or you have to do the Siskiyou Summit, which is, it can be extra brutal.
Yeah.
And they didn't salt it for decades, and I think now
they salt it. It's red dirt and salt.
They do the red dirt, but I think they, in addition to whatever the methyl ethyl salt.
It was melty.
Yeah.
It was, well, left lane was white, and I was like, I'm in a giant fucking van with snow tires on it. Get out of the way.
Yeah.
I have a terrible habit of not being afraid of driving in these conditions.
Yeah, same.
And it's like, I should probably slow down a little bit.
Yeah,
at some point. Tamara at one point looks like, how's the ground? I'm like, seems fine. Keep going. But yeah, so as soon as we hit Oregon, welcome to Oregon. The clouds were there. The rain was there. The snow was there.
Hi.
It's fucking 38 degrees here.
Ugh.
I was complaining about how, like, yesterday morning I woke up to 68 degree weather in California. It's like, ugh. In fact, it's funny because, like, we got out of the car after in Yreka to gas diesel it up. And I'm like, why the fuck is it so cold out here? What is this bullshit? Yeah, so 2 days of, well, 3 days of being in L.A. really just ruined it for me.
Yeah.
But, you know, we were just talking about it, like, essentially, the quote-unquote season is here.
Yeah.
People are already riding. We're already selling a ton of motorcycles. And, like,
yeah,
this coming Saturday, there's an event. Next weekend, there's the BDR event. And then, like, event and event and event. And before you know it, October's here. So I'm excited for it. I bitch about, sure, you know, it's getting busy and I don't have time for anything. But, like, truly, I relish in it. I love it.
No,
I'm super excited for it.
And then when the weather thing and the SoCal thing, I mean, I get it, but I don't. It doesn't. It is funny, after having lived here for 15, 16, whatever it is,
right,
years, I just don't, you just appreciate it more.
Yeah.
Whereas in California, it was like the laser beam would shine on you every day.
Every day.
And then it became, I don't know, because there's so many people and it's all brown and anything that's green is just fake.
Everything's green right now.
Yeah.
Dude.
It is neat to be.
Tailwind Pass is green.
That is a crazy thing.
It's
wild. It is neat to do that. Last year when I was doing the testing in Button Willow, which is just over the grapevine,
right,
in San Joaquin Valley, it was really cool because it was rainy last winter, at least a little bit like this. So when we were testing in January and February, it was like, wow. Crazy to see the screen, because most of the time, if you're used to it and you're used to driving up to the various racetracks from SoCal up, that's what I know.
Yeah.
It's just brown and just brown and just desert.
So much brown. Just brown after brown.
Yeah. So
code brown.
I don't miss it, but I tell you what, just like what you did, it's great to go back. And especially if you get the chance to go back and ride.
Yeah.
There, you get the taste of all of it. I mean, I would have gone in there. I would have had Zanku chicken. I would have had In-N-Out, and I would have ridden at least Andrews Crest, our highway, but most likely Andrews Forest Highway, and then Ojai, and right? Idlewild is great, but man, you have to go long. That's
go
a long
so
way.
So here's the thing. As locals, we tend to want to take people to our favorite places.
Yeah.
Even if the people are like, hey, I want to go to the touristy thing.
Yeah.
And I told Tamara, I'm like, hey, when we go down there, I kind of want to help you do the touristy thing. Take you through Angeles Crest Highway,
take you
to Venice.
No, this is way cooler that you did that.
So it was kind of, I mean, this was David's idea, and it turned out beautiful.
Yeah.
But the reason a lot of the locals don't like to go to the Crest on a weekend is because every fucking squid's out there.
It's horrible, yeah.
And it's not just squids. I mean, there's genuinely fast-riding people, but there's also idiots in cars.
Those are squids. I hate to tell you.
Yeah, that's fair. That's fair. They're squidding it up.
I was one of those
me
people
too, me
for
too.
A very long 100%.
Time. So it's funny because, like, it's just full of people, and they're in cars, and there are motorcycles, and there is also, like, you know, someone in their car just sightseeing,
yeah,
going 30 miles an hour, which is the speed limit. So it's a mission. It's the bit of a, you know,
it's a weekday deal. That's the only good time. Right.
So we were there on a Sunday and they were like, hey, let's go out here. There's less people. We'll have a blast, which we did.
Awesome.
So no complaints at all, but I would love to take him for him to experience the Crest because, you know, a friend of mine who's a car person had gone up it on Friday and was like, hey, it's clear. It's great to drive it. It's closed at Mount Wilson. You got to go down Upper Tahunga, and you can Upper Tahunga, that straight line that we all topped out our motorcycles at one point.
Dude. I used to have a friend, you'll like this, one of the guys I worked with at Burt's Motorcycle
Mall
in Azusa, California. At the time it was in Azusa. He was actually, this is appropriate on many levels. So he was the manager of the PDI department, the pre-delivery inspection department. Burt's is so big that there were four technicians dedicated to PDI. We would PDI 60 units a day in the summer.
That's bananas.
But it would be that's padded by jet skis. Because they're usually at, this is again late 90s.
At Burt's, you call them units, not motorcycles.
Big units. So
hey,
it was
a unit,
right? You had to be units. So we're talking two jet skis and a trailer. Like
that's three
this
units.
Was back in the it was and be, so back so that's padded, but it was still a lot of motorcycles.
It's a lot,
right? And so the manager of this, and I'm forgetting his name. It's gonna he would strangle me. I'm so sorry. He had a GSXR 1100, like a 1985 or 86.
Liquid cooled, bad boy.
No, oil cooled. Slab sided, like the first gen.
Yeah.
And it was so cool. And he had German ancestry, so it was German flag colors, which was pretty cool.
Of course it was.
Like different than you would ever imagine, but just German flag. Imagine that. And on the side of it was a deer symbol, the deer crossing road sign symbol.
Okay.
And you'd be like, why is that? Because he hit a deer on 9 Mile, which is Upper Tahunga.
Yep.
So that used to be called 9 Mile. Everybody called it 9 Mile because it's exactly 9 miles long.
Why is it called 9 Mile?
Right. And so he hit a deer on 9 Mile full speed and almost died. And so then had that on the side of his vehicle for a long time. And one time I ran into a dude that was on that bike. And he had purchased it from him, and he lived in Santa Barbara. And I randomly saw him somewhere on like the side of, I can't remember, the highways 154 from Ojai or whatever. I'm like, dude, that I know that bike. It was so, you know how small of a world it is.
God damn it, it's so small.
Anyway, so Upper Big Tahunga, awesome, yes. But so was it closed or this past week? Or you didn't?
No,
go
it was
to
open.
That.
It was open. Yeah. It was open all the way to Newcombs Ranch.
But you were like, nah.
Well, we were told, hey, let's just go here. Yeah. Like, fuck it, let's do a 400-mile. Round trip.
God, that actually makes me want to go do that.
It's so I made a joke because my father owns a bus company, and joking, I'm like, yo, pops, what would it be like to take one of these buses and retrofit the belly of the bus where all the shit goes in to be able to slip like, I don't know, 10 motorcycles in there and then like make the rest of the bus into this like uber luxurious liner. And we bring people from the Pacific Northwest in January to SoCal so they can go ride around in all these roads and relish in the sunshine for like 3 to 5 days.
Yeah.
And then they can just chill in this first class bus back home. And he was like, why wouldn't they just fly here? I'm like, don't fuck with my dreams, Dad.
Yeah, right, sure. But that's the type of thing, though. It would almost behoove you to be like, work with some rental agency that does Ducatis.
Right.
So you'd be like, hey, you thinking about something for next year? Let's go try it out. Let's do something over here, right? Because I could. Can you imagine if you had 4 days in LA and it was weekdays? I could take you on some of the most epic shit each day.
Oh god!
You'd have the loops that you do, and like, it would be so fun.
You'll be tired,
and then you'd leave, and you wouldn't have to. You wouldn't have to live in LA. No. You could come back up here to the beauty and wonderful.
Come back to your beautiful Pacific Northwest, where it's green and rainy and nice. that idea definitely did get floated around. Okay, tell me your Street Fighter story. All right, so
I bought a 1098 Street Fighter.
Widowmaker.
Fresh, because I just started working for Ducati.
Okay.
So in 2009, I started working for Ducati, and I can't remember if I got it in 09, but I'm pretty sure I did, because I went to... I think standard. Standard. Okay. I'm very rarely an S model. I usually look at it as... Sorry, but I look at it as complete BS. So I will take a vehicle that has the quote unquote lesser suspension and make it work, or I will retrofit an Ohlins damper on the rear. And I know that most of the forks are good, but it's dependent on the Ducati or whatever. If it's Showa stuff, it's awesome, and I qualified top 10 in an AMA national with Showa forks and shock. So you can't, right?
Like, Q, in all fairness, I've seen you ride faster on a track on knobby tires than most people with stickies.
But you know what I'm saying? Like, my brain's like, I don't need to spend that extra money, right? I will, though, eventually.
Someday.
So S models, they're whatever in that time. I don't know. I was like, I want the 7-spoke lightweight wheels.
Right.
I don't want what comes on the Street Fighter. So I waited until warranty 7-spoke wheels came in.
Awesome.
And I put them on. They're actually on the Terra Corsa now.
Oh, those are the wheels.
Those are the wheels that are on the Terra Corsa. Okay. Those very wheels.
Jesus, those wheels have been around.
I know that, right? So anyway, got that bike early on because I was like, okay, I can ride a naked bike. Out of all the bikes that were available, that's what I wanted. So I rode that, and I used it as a track day like vehicle. Straight up, most of the miles were on that. And in 12, when they came out with the, 848
version.
Yeah, 848 Street Fighter.
Which I dare say was a better setup on that chassis.
And that's the deal. That's why I wanted it. So I got it. I sold. And, you know, there's regrets. And that's, I wouldn't say that's a huge regret because I know I could find another one again. And
wait, which one do you regret selling? The 1098 or
the 1098?
Okay.
The absolute power corrupts absolutely part of that bike, specifically that bike, because it's a handlebar bike. riding from when I lived in Clackamas, which is probably, what, 20 minutes out of Portland to the core in the Moto Corsa.
Right.
And I would only do that every once in a blue moon because it was mostly, again, a track day bike. That bike was so obnoxious fast.
So.
Just and
especially
and
that iteration of a Street Fighter.
It was so raw and just amazing. Anyway, love the bike. And when I got the 848, it was a better all-around, easier, fun-to-ride, a slow bike, fast bike. But part of me was like, I wanted the Goldilocks in between. And I, to be honest with you, I haven't ridden it in over a decade, but I still have the 848 sitting in dust in my garage.
What?
Yeah.
How do we bring this thing back to glory?
This is one, if you go on the YouTubes and you look up 848 Tank Slapper. I wonder how I named it. So look, 848 Oregon Raceway Park.
Okay.
Crash.
ORP.
Yeah, and there's a really gnarly video of me getting a Tank Slapper crash that is... Discovery Channel paid me $700 to use it in some fucking
show. Stop it, really?
Yeah. That was a decade ago that happened.
Hey, we know you almost died. Here's $700 if we can use it.
Well, right? Somebody randomly approached me off of YouTube.
That's amazing.
Right? And was like, would you do this? I'm like, yeah, sure, I don't care, right? Anyway, so... After I crashed it, I mean, you can imagine that was a pretty gnarly crash.
Yeah.
And I decided, well, I'll put it back together. And I bought a bunch of parts, Olin shock and steering damper and all this other stuff.
Thing.
But then life happened and I just got, I bought another Ducati.
So all those parts on the bike just sitting in a pile?
Yeah. The bike.
This is giving me the sads.
I know, man. There's a lot of sads.
I feel like we should go honor this thing.
No, man. There's so many things in that garage that I'm like, I could start a YouTube channel.
You could.
Literally getting my shit together.
Can we just call your YouTube channel Barn Finds, but it's just your garage?
It's Garage Finds.
What's in here today?
Yeah. I know. Believe me, I've racked my brain on how to do it, but.
Quentin opened the garage, and you're never going to believe what he found.
Oh, Jesus Christ. There's so many things. Anyway, so that bike was bitching, but it just needed a little bit more to have that obnoxious, stupid power that the 1098 had.
Yeah, it needed another, like, 200-something cc's.
But not that much. I wanted to make it 1,000. Like, and I don't know. I was going to do some sort of, like, which pistons would do this and with which stroke and make it. I just, you know, whatever. Anyway, life happens. I bought a Multistrada 1200 and started riding that.
And that just ruins everything.
Right?
You know?
I just was like, yeah, whatever. And now I ride a big old dirt bike that's that's an adventure bike, right?
So you wanted to talk in depth about an email you got.
Oh, yeah. Okay, let's
open that guy up.
Yeah, this was really interesting.
So this is at webraptalk@gmail.com. Again, I love that you all send your questions, your thoughts, your feelings. Keep them coming. This one was more or less directed to Q, and I read it, and I thought this was really neat, so I forwarded it straight to Q, and Q wrote back via email like, dude, this is so bizarrely cool. I want to cover it. So go.
All right. So, hey, guys. Glad to have you back and doing the podcast. I have been listening since Quentin was on the Two Enthusiasts podcast. Quentin, I met you once at a mobile station on the corner of US 40 and US 34 in Granby, Colorado, sometime around 2015. So you can imagine when I read this, I'm like, what the fuck is this? Right? And I had to rag my brain. Why would I have been in Granby, Colorado? Home!
Why were you
home
there?
Of the Killdozer! Home of the kill, my favorite thing in the world,
amazing.
The Killdozer. Why was I in Granby, Colorado, right?
Were you there to honor the Killdozer?
I wish. All right, so, and by the way, there's part of me that does and part of me that doesn't. That goes with a lot of these weird people that go insane and do bad things.
Right.
But the Killdozer was next level awesome on a few levels.
Yeah.
So I can't remember. There's a documentary that came out recently.
Oh, there's all kinds of things.
Watch it. Find Killdozer documentary and watch it. And you'll feel very uncomfortable about all of it. Everything about it.
Yeah.
Like his side, their side. Anyway, Granby, Colorado, Killdozer. So I'm in Granby, Colorado. I'm like, when was I there? It's like, you were riding a blue DRZ 400 wearing a Marcy jacket. And I'm like, wow, what is this crazy? When was I on a DRZ 400? Then I remembered. I'm like, my buddy, one of the crew chiefs that worked at Graves with me, Jeff Sesmet, lives in Boulder, and he had convinced me to come to Boulder and rent a DRZ, and one day we would go ride trails above Boulder, and the next day I would just go tour around. And that's exactly when this was the next day I was alone
because
he had to work. And I was like, oh, I'll go over whatever the pass is in the big mountain pass in Colorado from everybody's going to, this is just like Yosemite.
They're screaming.
People are going to be like, no.
You son of a bitch, it's called blah, blah, blah.
Right. So and near Estes Park, whatever that is, that goes over the mountains, right, to Granby from Boulder.
Okay.
Right. So I had taken that poor little bike over that pass, and it was like, I think I can. barely get over there.
Adding load to a motorcycle.
Absolutely. But I wasn't like fully laden, but I did have bags on it. Anyway. Got down to Granby, got to wherever this person was, and was getting gas. And I remember it was him and his dad, and one of them was, I believe, on it. Well, let's read this. Okay. I was on an R1200RT, and my dad was on a Ducati Multistrada 1200. You gave us a tip for burping the clutch master cylinder on his bike. great to hear you back in the MA paddock, so that's Moto America paddock, and I will look for you at Road America. Okay, so I guess I was like, hey, nice Multistrada, you know, how's it going? Well, my clutch is feeling bad. Oh, well, you should do this. Can you imagine? Right, just me at a gas station just bullshitting.
That's
right?
Amazing.
It was. So when I remembered, I did remember, not clearly, but I remembered it enough to be like, oh, that's so cool that this dude.
And you were still at DNA at this point.
Yeah. I was working for, I had probably gone to Colorado, had done my dealer visits, and then stayed because I often would do that.
Right.
Stayed for the weekend after and went and rode because my friend Jeff, who is one of the best crew chiefs in the Moto America paddock or Road AMA that had ever existed. He's seriously high level dude. So he's still there as well. Anyway. For your next or future podcast, wondering if you could offer us home mechanics your top Desmo valve adjustment tips. I'm tearing into my N59 Panigale track bike to get it ready for the season and looking for some wisdom to supplement the service manual. Okay, that's first. So amazing situation.
Yep.
Really cool. I'm really stoked. This is Brent Keller from Madison, Wisconsin, which is a really rad town, by
right.
the way. All right, tips. That's a tough one because really the biggest tip is to have all the tools that you need and the shims. That's
right.
Most of the battle is you can read the manual, whatever the manual he's going to get, because you would hope that he would either download the copy of the manual or find it somewhere and then have the tools to do it, which is kind of tricky, right? Especially with the newer ones, with the Panigigolos, it's not as easy as it would be if you were like, hey, I have a 1995 Ducati Monster. I could show almost anybody how to do the valves on an older one. Doesn't mean they're going to do them right. Doesn't mean they're not going to need to go back to Moto Corsa, but you can show it way easier in that realm. Or even the later Testastretta motors. But once it gets into the Panigigolos, man, that's a heady thing. Doesn't mean it's not possible, but if you're into it, he's obviously into it enough where he wants to know, well, I want to check my valves. Dude, I don't know tips and tricks for that other than you're going to have to get really, really familiar with your feeler gauges. My recommendation is to go to Blue Point or Snap-on and find go-no-go feeler gauges that have the feeler gauge itself is ground down at the tip, just the tip. So that if it says 0.007 to 0.006, the 007 is the thick part, and the 006, that helps greatly with the time involved. Also, buy long feeler gauges. It's like you want to be able, like AJ from Motocore, and I'm sure Kevin probably does this as well. They have like a roll. They'll roll out their feeler gauges, and they'll have the long ones, and they'll have the various ones that they personally use for these valve checks. And you're just going to have to get very familiar with checking the clearances along the entire closing lobe of the cam, which is a very long thing. So you can't just put it at TDC compression and then assume that it's going to be good all the way through that. You have to disconnect everything enough to be able to spin it, which is not an easy thing. Or you have to know to spin the motor back and forth because on one of those Panigales, it's, you know, gear driven and all that stuff. So never, ever, ever in my life did I have to adjust the valves on one of those things because I never owned one and I never dealt with it. I was the service rep for it. And this kind of goes into, we could almost turn bend this into the industry thing. When you're the rep, you might not necessarily have to have your hands dirty with the newest, latest, greatest all the time.
Right.
I would have to do diagnostics for electrical shit, but I wouldn't have to ever like do a valve adjustment or, you know, replace a crankshaft. Very rarely. You might find me in the back of a shop in Kansas City with the bike in a crate on its side, pouring JB Weld into an area of a crankcase that was known to have porosities. You might find me doing that.
Allegedly.
But you're not going to find me doing a valve adjustment. So this might be a good one to get with Kevin. I think we should. Like, maybe this would be a cause to say, hey, and like, all right, can you give somebody a tip that's maybe racing or track dang a bike if they're doing this solo, other than the kind of cheeky, we'll take it to a dealer bullshit. If somebody is that dedicated that they're doing it,
yeah.
What would be that? For the other part of it would be you're about to do a bunch of stuff, and then what are you going to do when it comes time to turn the bike on? There's a lot of updates that need to happen. Unfortunately, there's a lot of resetting stuff that is part of the service, and this is part of the brave new world of it. If you have access to that, know how important that is, and I'll say that. That is what the dealers have. Yes, you can buy the DDS system, and I'm sure there's people
can
that
buy it as a non-dealer.
I don't even know.
I don't know that you can.
You can't buy that as
like
a non-dealer.
The process for us as a dealer to buy DDS, DDS is Ducati Diagnostic Systems, right? So it's like a $30-something hundred computer that allows us
with a dongle set up that can talk to
Bluetooth and it talks to the, but it allows the tech to do the thing, to diagnose it, and then to be able to reset things as they go on. It is proprietary as far as I know.
Yeah, but
and every brand has their version, like BMW.
So this goes to the next question.
Right.
But yes, so the bottom line is it's not easy, but I don't know if somebody has a hack. I'm not aware.
Be interesting if they do.
If there is whatever, because there was for older stuff.
Right.
There were ways to, when I was at Pro Italia, Pride Italia. We had FIM software, which is a company out of Australia. And we didn't even have, at the time, it was something called a Mathesis tester. We didn't even have that because we were using the software from FIM to read the codes and do this thing. So I grew up in a dealer that was out of compliance because we didn't even have the right tool. But we were making a way around it at the time. But this is in the late 90s when the technology was ramping up heavily.
Yeah.
And then eventually it went from that to the DDS-1. Which was this handheld unit that is a
royal
pain in the butt.
Oh, yeah. We don't use it. It's just there.
You actually have my Mathesis test.
Really?
Yes. Because
there's
these weird older bikes that sometimes you can't get them to chat without having the old shit.
Right.
Or it's easier. Frankly, I think ask Shawnee Bear, Shappy, or Kevin, hey, do you ever use the Mathesis? And they might say, oh, only if some old piece of shit SD2
comes
in, right?
900 CR, so maybe.
Yeah, you never know, right? Some of it, anyway. So this is what, to take it out of Ducati land, all the manufacturers, as fuel injection has come on, they all have some sort of diagnostic tool to read the codes and help you figure out what could be going wrong. Could be a sensor, could be something that's in, you know, it could be short in the ground, could be the ECU, whatever the thing is. And that's what how these
bummer
are.
That it's not just the like standardized OBD style like in a
well
car.
That
just
is
plug
a problem
it in and read the
that
fucking
is a,
thing.
That is something that I find to be
like, I'm saying this as a dealer.
Yeah, I know. Yeah.
This would be easier for everybody.
No, for sure.
If you just, oh,
would,
I don't know.
Going back to the original thing we talked about when we were talking about dealer interactions, it would behoove, you would be better off. Those people would put more miles on their bikes and they would buy more stuff from you.
100%.
Net, total, all right. Over the course of time, like soup to nuts, you'd have everybody would be better off. The people that would fuck up would take this tool and fuck up anyway,
yeah.
And then they'd bring your stuff to
right.
you. Or the people that
double.
Are doing well, they would reset their adaptive parameters after they did the tune-up, and then they'd run the bike as per the whatever, and then they'd have a happy 959. They'd go to Road America. They'd do their track day,
hell yeah.
And then they need a set of tires, right? And they'd come to you or whatever the thing is. So, again, you got to look at it like that. So going back to that, this is what his next thing was. All right. Also, good future tech topics might include your perspectives on right to repair, manufacturers selling, or in parentheses, not selling,
mm-hmm.
service manuals and aftermarket diagnostic scan tools. And then he puts in Melco Diag, which I don't know what that is, but that might be something that's like JP Diag,
okay.
GS911, etc. I've never heard of any of these things. I ride a Honda. I don't need to know anything. I just ride my Honda, man. I don't have to know this anymore. I've been gone from Ducati longer than I was there as of, I think, this year. So yeah. I'm so far out of the loop. I will ride them and I enjoy them and I still have enough contact. I'm privileged because I'd be like, hey, Kevin, can you hook the DDS up to my whatever bike I might need it? Or I have the old shit that I can.
Yeah.
Right. So I'm not as bothered by it. I also haven't seen as many failure modes, so I'm not as concerned with it. Whereas I think a lot of people are. They're like, oh, I need to have the diagnostic.
Yeah, there's a thought.
Because they
heads.
Think that some Ducati is just going to fail, and it's like, it's less than you think.
Right.
And you don't need as much as you think.
Right.
As much as you think you need it. And yes, if it was circa 1995, you absolutely needed it. You needed it so bad. But now, I don't know. These bikes are so good, and the dealer network is so robust, and it's just not as much of a concern. That said, people are geeky. They want to get into their vehicles. Totally. They want to go in there and see all the thing, right?
It's interesting from a dealer's perspective because, like, from where I see it, the geeky people that like to get into the thing and finagle with it and play with it and get to know it and really, you know, really get granular are sort of the minority.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that's because everyone doesn't have access to the old school style books and being able to, you know, do everything. I don't want to overgeneralize, but it just feels like people have less time and
they want to ride their bikes, not necessarily work on it.
Right.
Maybe.
And like Fortnite on YouTube made a pretty hilarious video about the Desert X and he nicknamed it the Dealer X because it's like, hey, how do I adjust the chain? Please see local dealer. How do I change there? Please see local dealer.
As annoying as that guy is, holy crap, did he have a really, really good point with that?
Yeah.
So how do you feel about that? Because it's like, this is ridiculous. These base level things, level. Adjusting a chain, F off. That should be very clear instructions
for that.
Super
easy. That should be easy as fuck. I agree. Yeah. So, and again, I'll probably get finger ragged at this, but we talked about this in the last episode. I think it behooves us to have people learn how to do the basics. At the very least, the basics. Like the thing that makes it where you can walk into your garage and look at your motorcycle and be able to see where your chain's at and just set it up properly so you're safe.
Yeah.
That's all I'm asking for. And frankly, if you can do that, that probably makes you a more competent, more aware rider.
Absolutely.
So I want that for those purposes. Yes, as a dealer, I'll make more money if I do every single fucking minutia, but I would rather deal with the bigger builds. If you go to my service manager and go, hey, can I get an oil change? Or if I go to him and go, hey, can I get an engine build? Guess who he's more excited about? The engine build person. That being said, I wonder if there is a bit of a different sect of people who buy high-end vehicles, right, like Ducatis, who say, I don't have the time or the desire to get my hands dirty, and I just want you to do all that for me.
I think we've been seeing that morph. So I have seen that at the turn of the century. The people that were in Ducatis were generally the gearhead, old school, true enthusiast motorcycle people that worked on their bikes, and they wanted to know. They would read Sport Rider magazine, like me, in the mid-90s, when Sport Rider magazine would literally tear the bike apart and rate how difficult it was to work on.
That.
It was amazing. And they'd show the picture of the bike denuded, and so that you could say, this was really difficult to get apart. And I remember that first time I read about the Ducati and how quickly it was easy to get to the, say, a 916.
Mm-hmm.
I think I've said this. You can field strip a 916 to the point where I can get to the valves so fast. Whereas now, it's a little spicy.
Now you take the fairings off of a Panjiggly V4S.
You barely touched the tip of the iceberg.
The first layer of the onion. There's so much more to go to.
Right.
And I had a conversation with Kevin, our master tech, about that. Like, how hard is it to get to that engine? And he's like, well, if you don't know what you're doing, it's going to take you a couple hours just to get to it.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's just getting to the engine.
Yeah. That's not doing
before you
thing.
Even start getting into the engine.
And like with everything, you get used to it. And like technicians, it really isn't that bad. If you're looking at, okay, was it 15 minutes to get to the valve covers on a 916? Yes. Maybe 20.
Wow.
like maybe you had your ways, right? You knew not to drain the coolant. You just flipped the radiator the way. And you knew not to take this off or do this or whatever the thing is. Like, you knew on a 900 SS, I'm just going to take the shock off. I just know that it's easier for me. I don't have to. It's two bolts, right? Anyway, so things like that happen. You get used to it. So I'm sure Kevin has that with all the things. But the first time I had to, when I cracked the cases on that Multistrada 1200 because I was sending it, and then I had to R&R the engine. Man, that was, I mean, it wasn't changed. That bad. It wasn't that bad, but it was pre, what is the cam timing thing?
That the DVT.
Okay, so whatever that is. So it was pre that, thank yeah. God. But after that, when we started, when I'd go over to Italy and I'd be sitting in the room watching all the stuff and they're like, and then this is how this
shit's
works.
Gone complicated.
I'm like, I don't want, unfortunately, anything to do
right.
with working on that. At all, not even a little bit. Like that depresses me. But at the same time, if you're telling me that it's an 18,000 mile service interval, okay, fair enough. That actually helps because if it brings along the line of the Hondas and the Yamahas and yada yada, okay, then I'm just not. I just don't want to do it anymore. I as the enthusiast, do not want to do that.
Right.
I want to ride my motorcycle.
Right.
I don't want to have to work on that.
I think majority of people are like that. And Brent is it? That's right.
Yeah,
into you?
Brent. Yeah.
So I think. There are the Brents of the world out there who like to get to know and they want to become intimately knowledgeable.
There is another Brent in Indianapolis that does
that. That's right.
That.
Who actually does this, by the way. But like, it's interesting to watch the sort of cultural shift because we're in our 40s, right? So we grew up learning how to build and fix the thing. You still work on your own stuff. Your Ford truck... Like you,
I had to remove the engine right, and reinstall exactly. the engine in my Ford
but
truck.
Like, yes. Your Ford truck.
Oh, but it was dead simple.
That's
it was
the thing.
Dead
if this
simple.
Was a new Ford truck yeah. with all of its stuff on there.
Cab off.
No
cab, you have to yeah. remove the cab. Yeah. Nope, I'm not
no,
touching
thank
it.
You.
Nope, no, I don't want
to
do it.
Here's it to the dealership. Please
yeah,
handle
yeah,
it
yeah.
for me. I'll handle it.
Absolutely.
And so that's the thing. I think, frankly, equipment has just gotten more complicated. And so like now it's not just as simple as... 15 minutes to get to the valves on 916 anymore. Now it's like a whole litany of shit you got to go through and
yeah,
do.
Sure.
And so when I read an email like this, that's like, hey, do you have any tips and, you know, tricks for me? I think of like the things on the 900 where you just
yeah.
move the radiator out of
yeah.
the way or
and
do
that's,
this.
There's like, nothing
those,
like that now.
It doesn't exist. It's,
I'm sure Kevin would probably be able to say, hey, you need this specific weirdo tool
right.
to do this, or you're going to have to buy this extension for this, to whatever the thing is. He probably does have some legitimately good tips and tricks,
totally.
But nothing like what it could be if it was like, hey, I've got this old monster. What do you do for ride height setup and yada, yada? I'm like, oh, let me tell you.
I
right?
got that one down.
Right? And so that's it, it's simpler, older times. If somebody says, hey, I have an Africa Twin, you have any tips? I'd be like, you can go to my YouTube channel and you can watch. I do have like, here is like some stupid things that they like routing and how to get fuel lines off to where
right.
you don't fuck them up and shit like that. And I've done that and I've gotten feedback like, dude, thank you. You saved me a bunch of time. Great. Super simple shit like that. But I'm not going to have that for this specific case for him. He is going to dive into it and he's in Wisconsin. He's going to be doing this in the middle of winter. He's going to get into it and he's going to learn his own way.
Yeah, he's got time for that.
I feel bad because I don't have those fucking heater badass demon tech things, but we could probably investigate for him, but
I have an
he'll
answer,
probably
though.
Be done.
I have an answer that's not what you think it's going to be.
Okay.
So remember, dealerships are filled with people. And these people are there to make money and they're there to it's their livelihood, just like whatever it is you do is your livelihood. That being said, they are people and connections with these people helps. I don't mean like, hey, I got a guy. I mean like take the time to go to these dealerships and get to know them if you trust them. And get to know the techs and get to know the service department and your apparel department and parts department.
And don't be a dick.
Don't be a fucking dick.
Oh.
Show up and be a human being and just talk to them. Don't go, because we get it. Sometimes
yep.
I've heard the stealership bullshit. I totally get it. The thing we do at our shop is anyone that shows up once over more than two or three times, we get to know their face. We start talking to them. Yeah. What's your story? Like, we want to get to know you because I, as a human being, I'm just curious. My friends call me Whiskers. I'm curious like a cat. So,
what is that from?
From Harry Carey.
Oh,
hi.
Wow. Huh.
If the moon was made out of barbecue spare ribs, would you eat it? I know I would.
I'd have to watch that. I
oh,
don't
my God.
I don't know it.
Oh, man. I know so many people are yelling at you right now. So, go to your shop. I don't care what the fuck bike it is you ride. Go to that shop, especially if it's not some big mega mall shop.
Yeah.
And
frankly, only if it's
definitely.
Unfortunately, right?
Turnover is turnover.
Smaller shops are not going to have as much turnover. Right. They're going to be more, especially if they're smaller branded, not as many brands.
Right.
Right. And it, and we watch this over and over and over. In the Ducati world, it's usually Ducati, Triumph, and BMW.
Right.
Some permutation of that.
Some Euro.
Out of the 30 dealerships that I had, I think 18 of them were also BMW dealerships, right? So you see that because enthusiasm for Euro brands definitely is. It makes sense to not have a Ducati Honda shop. It does, even though that's what I'd have, right? If I was going to start a shop. But that would be the type of thing. You get in and you kind of develop a relationship. I don't know how to say that. It's not easy,
But it's not hard. Just show up and be nice. Like, bring some fucking donuts for the service boys. Because techs are techs. I don't care if it's cars, boats, motorcycles.
Time. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, just go hang out with them. Most of these dudes are beer drinking, donut eating, you know.
Motorcycle riding people. Yes.
Guitar shredding. Yeah. I'm thinking of my dudes.
Yeah.
You know, but they are human beings, and they're nerds and geeks, and they like to get nerded out and geeked out over stuff. I'm not saying go there immediately and be like, hey, I have a question. How do I adjust my valves? They're going to be like, well, you can make an appointment.
Yeah, you can show up
and we can do it for you.
This is the gray area of this, is you don't want to waste anybody's time.
No.
But if you show up and you're not a dick and you're there and you go to the track days, which, again, not every shop has this, but maybe you go to their events and you go to they're debuting a bike. When they get a new bike, show up to come have a look at it. Doesn't mean you're going to buy it. I get it. But don't waste people's time. That's the key, is knowing – this is where the crux point is knowing how much time to say, hi, how are you doing, and not take away. Knowing if a salesperson is engaged with somebody, having the kind of social cues
aptitude
to know that, hey, they're actually involved with somebody and they're doing their job.
Yeah.
And same goes on the technician side. That said, it's tough. You walk up and then you get accosted by, say, a service writer. And it's accosted because they're not like – they are like a defense.
Totally.
They have to keep their technicians working.
Most techs don't want you to fucking hover over
them. But this goes to an interesting tale. I'll tell you an old tale.
Okay.
Maybe you and I have had this conversation. Pry it out of you. There I am, 19, 20, 21, 22 years old. I think that was when I was there. Can you imagine? Little Q, right?
little baby Q. Skinny Q.
And I was positioned next to the door where the service writer sat. And I was the young, gregarious, little racer, right? So I raced, and I was a mechanic, and I was the little long-haired Q. So people would then come to me.
I love that so much.
Just on general principle, but also the service writer then ended up being a lifelong friend, Patrick. He would then say, hey, I've got a question. This person would like to ask a question. Are you okay, right? We would upsell so much labor from that. It was unreal. And it got the other technicians angry. So then the technicians would go complain to the freaking Bill Nation to the point where, and I have this letter. I kept it because it's so good.
That's amazing.
It was basically a letter saying that I had to stop talking to customers.
What? You're helping the dealership. I would never, ever, ever.
This was the beginning of the end for me. Because as soon as I got that letter, I'm like,
politics.
I don't need to be here, right? I don't need to be involved with a place that is so stupid that they don't understand. Like, it'd be one thing if I was also, like, hideously unproductive, which I'm sure I wasn't great, but I was 22 years old. Like, I wasn't going to be a demon tech at that time anyway. But I was also bringing in stuff, and unfortunately, that meant I was doing a lot of fork services and suspension setups, stuff that barely took any effort, that just was like knowledge. And the people would – I'd click like five clickers, and then all of a sudden transform – those bikes were not that good in that time, or I shouldn't say they weren't good. They just didn't come out of the factory that good, and you would have to tweak on them to make them good.
They needed some work.
And frankly, that could happen now. I don't know, but I know then it made a huge difference. Monsters and 916s and Aprilia Miles, getting the setup right, which we knew because we were doing track days and we knew all the fast people and we rode them themselves. So we kind of knew, hey, you raise the right height with this and lower the right height with it, blah, 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 blah. And I knew it. And because I was a racer and they could see my 125 sitting there looking badass and we'd have that conversation, adds legitimacy, adds authenticity to the experience.
Absolutely.
So the same thing goes with, say, your shop. It's just that 80-20 rule. only 20% of the shops have that ability, right? But find that. If you're in that realm.
I promise your city has one.
So find that and get involved with these people, because I know I was young and enthusiastic. If I saw that somebody was interested and really wanted to know and wasn't just blowing smoke or was asking questions so that they could seem like they were smart,
right.
Which I don't know how – there's probably a phrase – I bet there's a Japanese word for that or a German word for
I
that.
I bet there's a German word for it.
That would be extremely really good.
WeRapTalk@gmail.com. If you speak German and there's a German word for someone who just speaks to sound smart.
Yeah. Yeah.
I want it.
Yeah, that'd be good. So, but we experienced that, and you would kind of have to filter that. Even as a young person, I had to filter that. Imagine what it was like after I became a full-on race technician and then became a Ducati service. That I had to be like, be careful about who I told I did what, right? And same goes for this. Somebody might approach me and, but now I don't give a shit. Like, I have no cross to bear.
Yeah,
somebody sees me in my uniform at a race, like Moto America, this guy's bringing up, hey, I might see you at Road America. So if you see me down in COTA and you happen to have a pit pass and you see Q and Harley Davidson orange and black.
First of all, take a picture of that.
It's just going to be bizarre. And I'm in the pits. Know that I'm working and I'm busy. But if it looks like I might be like taking a break, by all means, say something. Yes. I might just say, hey, come back at whatever time, right? But that type
of
thing.
You can tell when Q's busy. He's walking very fast. It's that look on his face. It's the resting working face.
Dude, the first test with the last year with Wespe, the technician that I worked with, who was an ex-racer, high-level ex-racer, Robbie, we had to go somewhere pretty early on in the test and go walk somewhere. And we're going, and he's like, you freaking Graves boys, because he had worked with another one of my coworkers from Graves 50 years. He's like, you Graves boys don't know how to go slow. And I'm like, you just the way it is. And most people that know me would be like, you walk fast, or you right? Because I'm not that, like, I don't have
that
manic.
That Q shuffle
but
going,
once you get to the racetrack, you get into fucking race mode, right? So anyway, so if you see me, by all means, and this is coming up at COTA, or I guess Daytona. If you go into Daytona, it's happening next weekend.
Yeah.
Not this coming weekend, but second weekend in March.
The 9th?
Yeah. So if you see me, I'll be in the Vance and Hines area. Say hi, and if I don't have time, I'll say, hey, come back.
I'm
going to
give you BrapTalk stickers.
Okay.
If you see Q,
yeah,
maybe
come
you'll
get
have
a
couple in your pocket and just take one and give one to someone.
I have to play it cool with the new team because they don't know. I'm not saying any. I don't
be cool, honey bunny.
I can't say the blank. Be cool. Tell that blank to chill out. Anyway, yeah, no, but for sure, I definitely don't mind it. Don't know that I don't mind it. Just know that I might not have the time immediately right then. Now, that said, and this goes for everybody, if you're at one of the races, find out where the bikes go after they've qualified and raced. They go to something called Parc Fermé. Parc Fermé is a gated-off area where all the bikes have to go for half an hour to 40 minutes after. It's a pain in the ass. I hate it. It's stupid. But it actually is good because then you do get a second to just sit and chill. So you like, I have to sit with the bikes. That way nobody finger fucks the bike. That is the perfect time to come say hi.
Just sitting there.
So find out where Parc Fermé is. Find out when we qualify and find out when we race. And then go there afterwards if you want to say hi. Okay. That goes for friends and people that are on this.
Friends and the family. Yeah, I think go be involved with your tiny little communities that are dealerships and riding groups and stuff like that. That's usually the best way of getting to know things, learning a little bit here and there. Like, there's going to be a young Q at a dealership who is dying to impart his wisdom to you.
Yeah, for sure.
Like, and the only way you're going to get to know that is to go there repeatedly and just become a regular, be a face that they get to see. It's like Cheers when you walk in and everyone's like, what's up, Norm?
Yeah.
Right? Just like, you're the dude on a Saturday.
You're dating yourself pretty heavily there.
Fuck, I know, dude. I'm 45 now. take a box of donuts. You know, if you got a six-pack of beer or something.
And bring your enthusiasm, though. A lot of it is the enthusiasm, and you got to have the enthusiasms,
bring the enthusiasm. We want to see you interested. We want to see you engaged. We want to see you at the rides. We want to see you at the rallies, the poker runs, if that's your thing. I made a face. I think it's important, and I think that's the thing. I know it's a long-winded answer to, hey, do you have any tips or tricks to how to fix my 959 Panigale? The short answer is no. The long answer is yes, if you keep going to your shop and make friends with them, you could probably learn a thing or two about it.
But it is a tough thing. Somebody in Madison, there's no Ducati.
I bet you money, there is probably someone that sells a proper like how-to manual, a shop manual online.
Well,
I've seen PDFs of these things.
I would assume nowadays it's basically you go on to whatever. I'm not much of a forum person, but you either find the forum or you go to the Facebook Marketplace or whatever it is.
Fuck, I bet you it's on eBay, dude. I bet they're selling that shit on Amazon or on eBay.
Unfortunately, that is the it. Like, follow it as much as you possibly can. Use your brain to feel out the like the braking procedure. You just have to use your gut. Say, you know, do I really need to go 4,000 RPM for this many miles? Probably not.
If you have a Triumph, it tells you yes, it's on the tank.
Yeah, right.
It's a terrifying giant sticker.
I bet. And they're like, ooh. whereas, and the same goes for the, like, is that valve clearance? Do you really need to have 0.00 this? Yeah. So know that when it comes to a bike that's that sharp and high level, don't screw with whatever they're suggesting in there. Definitely go by the book. If it was, say, a 30-year-old Ducati, we might have another conversation about where you can go, right, or whatever. But I would say if there's anything, definitely go buy the book. It just cover your ass. That will say that. Because these things, especially the Panigale Super Quadro engine, man, that is a very highly strung thing. That said, they're fairly robust.
Yeah,
I don't. No, I can't remember them. Yes, there would be people that would race them and
totally
like do stupid shit to them and then break them because they have overread them. Yeah, yeah, yeah. But it wasn't like, ooh, each one of those has this failure mode. No, that's not a problem.
No, we just haven't seen like an influx of any particular one of those having that level of failure at all. It's fascinating, actually. So like,
whereas the bigger Multistratas, they started getting to the point where they're stressed. That Testastretta Evo engine, well, you know, especially if somebody was spicy with it, that would rev them. They would be
so impressed with. So I had that 2013 Pikes Peak, and I was just out there track day after track day on that thing, and I was impressed. And so, like, it came time for its first valve adjustment at 15,000 miles, and Kevin opened it up, and even he was like, dude, one of your valves was out of
No,
sync.
They got the Testastretta motor, so this would have been like 08 and on Ducati 4-valve engines. Remarkably robust. That Street Fighter I talked about, which was 6,000 miles, most of it track day.
Right.
I don't think I adjusted a valve. I might have adjusted one or two, but maybe one. No, yeah. I don't even think I had to yank cams. Anyway, crazy, crazy. Not, that is bizarre if you came from the era of the turn of the century where the bikes would be completely fucked if
just
you tried to.
Fucked so
every shim would be all the closing, all the half rings would be beaten to death. And anyway, so it's a different world. They figured out the geometries. They figured out how to make things work, and it's really good. Same goes for, say, I'm sure, a BMW, except for a Toprak's bike, apparently, because his bike blew the F up in the second race of the World Superbike Series.
How?
I don't know. BMW power, right?
Ooh, fucking lots of power on those Beamers. Simo, who got the keys to my Beamer? Damn.
All right, so back to that. Thank you for writing in. That was really, they're super stoked because the weird connection with somebody that I talked to.
So cool.
That then figured out who I was enough to listen to me on a podcast. I'd love to know that story. Like, wait.
Right, like, how did you find? I want to know the connection.
Did you remember my name enough to then when we, because I didn't do the, well, maybe it was only like a year later or two. Maybe, I don't know. Because if he said it was 2015, which it probably was like 14, 15,
right.
I think we started doing that in 15, 16. So maybe he was like, hey, I know, right?
Wait a
but
minute.
What a weird coincidence. Coincidence?
Coincidence.
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 He was able to then be like, hey, I'm going to, you know, talk to you guys now, which was super cool. Super chuffed
by that. The world just keeps on shrinking.
Yeah, it does.
I think next week we're going to talk a little bit about, let's talk about the inner workings of a dealership, because he brought up a really good question about, you know, sort of like an owner's, a rider's right to be able to work
own
thing.
Sure.
And it made me think about just modern vehicles in general, right? Whether it's a Ford F-150 or a Panigale.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And how that era of going to Napa and buying the, you know, whatever brand book of how to work on your thing has sort of moved on to a different direction.
Yeah, it's similar to conversation what we just had. I'm sure there's going to be a lot of overlap, but it is worthwhile to dig into it a little.
I think so. I really do want to, because we teased about it last episode. Next episode, I definitely want to talk about the inner workings of a dealership. I think it's super important we can start talking about the motorcycle industry jobs in general.
Yeah.
I've started doing a little bit of research.
Yep.
So I'm going to have some data of like what's out there and what is it they do and what
because
does it look
frankly,
like?
Frankly, I want to, like, if you have, I'm in it in a weird way.
Right.
So I can kind of.
We're both in it in weird ways.
We are. So then we could, I'd love to have the back and forth because then we could be like, where is the industry right now? Where can you work? What is good? What is not? That's what I'm curious about.
So WeBrapTalk@gmail.com. If you have any questions about, you know, how, what's up in a dealership, any question, really come at me. Or just industry level questions of what jobs are out there. If you've ever been curious about it, or if you've ever had
bike,
a question.
Bike curious.
I feel like that's a brand.
I think it is.
I feel like it is.
But it just fit.
Bike curious. Interesting. So write into us. Love to hear your thoughts or your questions. If you are a fellow industry person, and you want to give us some fun stories that are worthy of repeating.
Or if even if it's on the DL, we'll put you on the DL.
We'll definitely DL it. I'll blur out your name on the podcast.
We're DTP on that.
we're DTP this down to podcast for you. I think it's going to be a t-shirt, DTP, down the podcast. God, I wonder if that's available. we'll definitely talk about that. It's really, really interesting to me because I feel like we're the bartenders.
Huh.
And people come into the shop and they're like, it's so cool what you do. And it's like, well, yeah, from your perspective, it is. And I agree, it is pretty cool, but it's work.
But this is a lot of work.
This is a lot of fucking work. It's dynamic and it's stressful and it has its ups and downs. And a lot of us just do it with a grin on our face because it's what we signed up to do a long time ago.
And I now have been watching, seriously, for 25 years. The people come in and be like, I want to do what you do.
Yeah.
This is like, I've watched it at the dealership. I've watched it at the race team. I've watched it at the manufacturer. Like, oh, how do I get in the industry? And I'm like,
to most people, it looks like a hobby.
And that's the thing.
That's the thing.
That's part of the conversation.
Because to most motorcyclists, motorcycling is a hobby.
Yeah.
And what we do is we're the cool bartenders serving up all the cool drinks.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, we got to clean this shit.
And deal with the drunks and deal with the drugs. Oh, man.
So it's got its ups and downs, and I'm really excited to talk about it. So I want to hear from you, WeBrapTalk@gmail.com. Ask me your questions. Tell me your thoughts on any industry, knowing that my forte is the dealership side, but definitely been around the block a couple of times, and Quentin even more so than me. So really super psyched to talk about that in the next one. Until then, I don't have a whole lot more to talk about tonight. How about you?
No.
What do you say?
I say stay bike curious.
Stay bike curious. I say safety third, make good choices. I love you, bye.